Regional Australia is angry, and the government knows it.
And look at these iconic fish of Australia being treated like this. You have to be bloody disgusted with yourself.
The coalition between the Liberal and the National parties is as delicate as ever.
Specifically, an $80 million water buyback deal 2 years ago signed off by the former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce.
As moderate independents chip away at blue ribbon inner city Liberal seats, independents are also wooing national voters in regional electorates with a message that's resonating. The coalition and people in Canberra don't care about you. The soap opera antics also haven't helped. Voters in Conservative seats have watched on as former leader Barnaby Joyce had an affair with a staffer.
In doing so, he has set off a world of woe for those women and appalled all of us.
$150,000, Barnaby Joyce has done a tell-all commercial TV interview.
And Junior Minister Andrew Broad became embroiled in a sugar baby scandal in Hong Kong.
Andrew Broad's now a life-size Nationals distraction.
Add to that a prolonged drought, mass fish kills in the Murray-Darling Basin, leadership instability and a political insurgency by the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party. Some in the Nats are wondering whether this might be the beginning of the end.
We have been a good government. This is an unnecessary distraction against the message that we are selling.
This election, regional Australia is waiting for the government with baseball bats.
Are you prepared to front a royal commission, Barnaby Joyce?
Of course I am. I won't give a toss.
This is Please Explain. I'm Canberra Bureau Chief Bevan Shields, stepping in for Tory Maguire. This week, going bush. What will happen if voters desert the Nationals at the May 18 election? Associate Editor Tony Wright has spent decades traversing regional Australia, talking to voters about how their lives and communities are changing. We've sent him on the road on his trusty motorbike to cover the campaign.
I'm simply travelling around on my motorcycle and I've come through the Mallee, and I've met a couple of characters here in the supermarket. First one is Ron.
Ronald Edward Smith.
Ronald, how old are you?
I was 90 in 7th of October last year.
And you've lived here all your life?
Yes, yep. I was a farmer, yep.
Mallee is a very big electorate. It's been National Party for a long time. What do you think will be happening here at the election?
Got no idea.
And he joins us from Sea Lake in northwest Victoria. Tony, welcome.
Good morning, Bevan.
So what are they telling you about the government?
The thing about this electorate, of course, is that Andrew Broad was the member, and he had the great privilege of holding the safest seat in all of Australia. That is this one, Mallee. He held it by 20% or so.
Did you know Andrew Broad?
Yeah, I have seen him, yeah. He gave us some mandarins one day, that bloke.
Yeah.
No, I have seen him a couple of times.
Yeah. But of course he's gone now because he got a bit tied up in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he had to step aside after a scandal involving a sugar babe in Hong Kong. So suddenly this electorate is much more interesting. It's got quite a few candidates. The Nationals have chosen Anne Webster, who would be the first female to hold the seat should she win, and you would imagine she would. But there are four independents, one Green, one United Australian Party, a Citizens Electoral Council, one Science Party. So suddenly it feels perhaps that huge margin might be at risk. I'm heading to cross the Murray River itself today, and that changes everything. The river is flowing strong, but farmers on either side who rely on irrigation water are screaming blue murder because their allocations of water have been cut. This has put them at a great disadvantage to those who are much richer or are involved simply in the water trade. And so Murray-Darling Plan, which took years and years and years to put together, is being looked at by farmers in a pretty dark light, and they're looking at the major parties in an equally dark light over the river in Farrer, which has been held by the Liberal Party for quite some time by Susan Ley, who, of course, is a minister in the government. Things are much less certain. The Mayor of Albury, Kevin Mack, who is running as an independent, and he's running very, very hard indeed on water, and farmers are holding rallies at which he speaks, where they are, as I say, screaming blue murder.
Tony, it's a bit of a cliche, but the Murray River really is the lifeblood of so many of those communities you're travelling through. Can you just paint a bit more of a detailed picture of the state of the river and why water really matters to these electorates?
The Murray River and the Darling, of course, are the food bowl of Australia. Without the Murray River and the water it provides for irrigation and the Darling River, you really would be importing all your food to Australia. And the drought is, by the way, the other element that is making people pretty anxious in this election. And the farmers who are voters, and the little towns and the bigger towns that rely on the river's water, are saying, well, you know, it's all very well to talk about environmental flows, but we need water as well. And so you need the wisdom of Solomon to actually work out how this can continue operating. And under the current plan, which all the governments, all the major parties don't want to change, the farmers are up and down the river protesting, saying this plan isn't working, we need it paused and reset. Well, that makes it very difficult for the big parties, and it makes it easier for independents who say, well, yes, we agree with you.
The coalition is bracing for a very bad result in some inner Melbourne seats, but what are some of the electorates that are at risk of falling in regional Victoria and along the border?
While it seems almost impossible, the seat of Farrer, held by Susan Ley, has suddenly got into play because you've got Kevin Mack, this mayor of Albury, suddenly getting a lot of farmers on side and making a lot of noise. And he has on his team of advisors three former editors. And one of them worked with Cathy McGowan in Indi, who was perhaps the most successful independent to turn around a coalition-held seat in Australian history.
And if that happens, Tony, if that seat does fall, do you think that is voters voting for the independent or against the government?
I think it would be essentially against the government. Now, I'm not suggesting that this will happen. That 20% margin is an enormous lead to start with. It is one of those seats that has always been coalition held. If that were to happen, however, that would be cataclysmic for the government in the bush. And we already know the two National Party seats along in the irrigation areas fell during the New South Wales election that no one even imagined could be lost. While Susan Ley is not from the National Party, she's a Liberal, a lot of people I've spoken to around the place just talk about the Liberal Party or the National Party as exactly the same. In fact, I've got quite a number of people on the record as saying exactly that.
George, how old are you?
I'm 83.
With the coming election in this town that Bob Menzies was born in, who do you think might win this seat?
I can't even remember whose the seat is now, but I hope it's Liberal.
It's been National Party for a long time. I think ever since...
That's as good as Liberal.
National is.
Yeah. They're in together.
The idea that an independent could get up here, what's your view about that? Any chance?
I don't really know whether it would be better or not so good. So long as it's on this side, we're right.
You mean the Conservative side?
Yeah. As you mentioned, I'm in Sea Lake. And here... And at my last stop, Jeparit, nobody really thought too much about politics at all. they just figure, oh, well, you know, there's an election coming on and the Nationals will get back because they always do. They don't see any difference.
I'm talking to Lee Craggs. on his front porch in Japarit. Lee, how long have you lived in Japarit?
20 months. We moved here from the desert in Central Australia. Non-political I am. They're all the same as each other nowadays, the political parties. They used to be the Labor was for the workers and the Liberal Nationals were for the farms and factories. But they're all blended into one same milkshake flavour now.
So they're seeing a Liberal National Party that is not in touch with their concerns. It gives you an indication that farmers are rallying on behalf of an independent over water. Well, you know, things have changed very radically.
Tony, you've covered 12 federal elections now. How is this one different to all the others?
Well, I think the difference here is that Australians all over the place are weary of politics and wary of putting their lot with anybody in particular. They're just sort of saying, well, you know, maybe we should just be thinking about ourselves. This is from a conversation yesterday. For the first time, this chap I was talking to in a supermarket cafe said, well, you know, we always voted out here the same way as our dads and our grandfathers, but suddenly maybe we should be thinking about ourselves and seeing things a bit wider, because the big parties don't seem to have done what we feel they should have done.
Tony, thanks for your time. Travel safe and no speeding.
No, indeed. Although there are long distances to go, Bevan. But of course I won't speed.
Have fun. Enjoy. Bye. Thank you.
This is Kate McClymont, investigative journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald. Hundreds of stories every week are produced by me and my colleagues at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, keeping an eye on corruption and cronyism in politics, sport and business. And we couldn't do it without the support of our subscribers. For 50 cents a day, know you're contributing to great journalism. Search for Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald.
Joining us to make sense of all of this is our chief political correspondent, David Crowe, and senior writer and columnist, Jacqueline Maley. Welcome to you both.
G'day, Bevan.
Hello, Bevan.
David, just how bad are things for the Nats right now?
I think they're really challenging for the Nats. I think they'd be challenging, they are challenging for both parties, and they'd be challenging for any parties in the situation now that they're in, which is after 6 years in government. You have more of your record that's exposed to challenge. You've got to actually justify some of the decisions that you've made. And it does become more difficult, especially difficult when you look at the last few years. You've had three prime ministers in two terms. You've also had three deputy prime ministers. The Nats have moved from Warren Truss. They've taken the gamble of Barnaby Joyce as their leader and then seen a huge upheaval under his leadership, and then they've moved on to Michael McCormack. So I think it's been challenging for them all the way through. I think they've got a lot of internal unhappiness because of those leadership transitions, and they've had this question that they've been dealing with about who do they stand for, what do they represent, at the same time that they've had parties like the Shooters coming after them from their base. During the time when Barnaby was leader, they did have an internal debate about who they stood for, whether they should modernise their party, whether they only appeal to farmers. Barnaby was the kind of leader who put on an Akubra, cracked a whip in the marble foyer of Parliament House and appealed to that base. But there was always a question about whether they should be trying to appeal to a changing world in regional Australia. More women, for instance, people who didn't only earn their living on the land or from the land, in regional Australia. And that's something that they've grappled with. They've tried to move on with Michael McCormack, but it's, as the Liberals have found and as Scott Morrison has found, it's very difficult to move on. In the same way that Scott Morrison has to deal with the interventions from Malcolm Turnbull as the previous leader, Michael McCormack has to deal with the interventions of Barnaby Joyce, which are not helpful. And we've seen Barnaby being off the reservation in some of his interviews. And this is what happens with former leaders who lose power. They can intervene in wild and unpredictable ways. And so these are all the challenges that the Nationals face. At the same time, they have these new competitors like the Shooters.
Jackie, David alluded to that, but, you know, the drought, these horrible fish kills, a slow regional economy, all of that has contributed to this red-hot anger in the bush. But I just wonder if there's a more fundamental problem here in that the political philosophy of Nationals MPs no longer really aligns with the electorate. Do you think the Nationals represent the hopes and dreams and aspirations of regional voters, or is there a problem there?
Look, I think increasingly there is a bit of a divide and a bit of a departure. Just as we've seen with the Federal Liberal Party, that, you know, the parliamentary party has sort of departed from mainstream Australia on a few key issues. I'm thinking sort of climate change and same-sex marriage with the Libs. And with the Nats, I think there's a similar sort of dynamic at play. You know, the rural and regional Australia is changing in its nature. You have increasingly sort of urbanisation within the regional areas. So the actual, you know, it's not all sort of farmers and you know, I don't know, cattlemen out in the regions. It's sort of like teachers, nurses, public service workers in the regional centres. And, you know, the Nats do have a particular problem when it comes to female representation. It's not something that they've even really begun to address at a sort of organisational level. The New South Wales Nats have a notional target of like 50/50 female representation by 2025, which is just not going to happen. And the Federal National Party doesn't have any target at all. So, I mean, one of the contacts I was speaking to this morning said, you know, there wouldn't be a woman under 30 in any regional electorate who votes for us. Like, it's sort of, and that will be, that ship's going to take a long time to turn around, and it's sort of a existential question really about how a socially conservative rural and regional party does modernise without splitting its base.
Does the party have a problem with women voters, do you think?
Look, I think there's probably a steep generational divide. So just as in the Liberal Party, the rusted on base and people who are doing, you know, people who are sitting on pre-selection panels and voting in pre-selections, the grassroots members are probably a lot of them are older women, or a lot of them are older women in the Nats who are socially conservative and don't particularly worry about, you know, matters of female representation. But on the other hand, you have younger women, middle-aged women, women, you know, who are, I suppose, modern in their outlook, who would look at the Nats and see not many faces that represent them and maybe their cares and struggles. And also, you know, obviously Barnaby Joyce's extremely messy personal life has left a very bad taste in the mouths of a lot of female voters in the regions.
The Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party picked up three lower house seats in the recent New South Wales state election, and they're now contesting key seats at the federal poll. How did they suddenly become such a serious force in politics?
They appeal to that base that has felt neglected by the Nationals, and it just highlights that problem of searching for the middle ground in the electorate and risking the loss of your base. And we've seen that been a major challenge for the coalition over recent years. The Liberals have been so worried about the loss of their base to One Nation, and the Nationals now have to look over their shoulder at the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers. Guns obviously have been one issue, because not just with John Howard's gun laws from 1996, but guns came up in the parliament when Malcolm Turnbull was leader, and there was a dispute with Tony Abbott over some changes that were agreed with David Lionhelm, the Liberal Democratic Party senator. So these issues come up continually. They're a source of aggravation, and the Nationals have to show loyalty with the Liberals in government. It's, in a sense, it's easier for the Nationals to have a policy dispute with the Liberals when they're out of government, but in government you've got to show a degree of loyalty, and that's been difficult for the Nats. And we've seen those three seats go to the Shooters in New South Wales. I don't think it's just a New South Wales issue. It can be manifested in other ways in other states as well. And I find it really interesting with Queensland, the very structure of the party in Queensland can make it difficult for the Nationals. The Liberal National Party is one organisation in Queensland. They are bound with one policy, bound to the Liberals in that formal way. It becomes more difficult for the Nationals to differentiate themselves from the Liberals and actually send a different message to a different cohort of voters. And I think this coming election is actually a major test of whether that combined structure in Queensland is the most effective way for them to gain votes. We'll find out after the May 18 election. In New South Wales, you do have different structures. They have a shared Senate ticket. So there are questions about whether they need a greater division between those two parties in order to appeal to different groups of voters. And that's it's not easy for them. It's really hard.
So, David, which party needs the other more right now, the Liberals or the Nationals?
The Nationals need the Liberals more. It's just a sheer function of size. The Liberals, you know, they're the major force in picking up seats. That's been a long-term issue for the coalition in the sense of the lower proportion of seats within the coalition that are held by the Nationals. And we're seeing some real pressure on the Nationals coming at this election. We've got seats like Cowper in northern New South Wales, where the Nationals have got a new candidate, Patrick Conaghan, who's up against Rob Oakeshott. Can Rob Oakeshott make a comeback? Former National State MP, became a federal independent, and is still challenging that party. That's an interesting contest. And then you've got Queensland, where you've got George Christensen, huge clouds over him. He's up against Belinda Hassan from Labor. In Flynn, there's Ken O'Dowd. In Capricornio, there's Michelle Landry. They're all, those last two seats are two of the most marginal in the parliament. And so I think the Nationals are under huge pressure at this election and have the possible outcome where they end up with fewer seats within the coalition, a weakening of their influence within the coalition.
So, David, you're very good at your job and you're always in touch with ministers and backbenchers. How do the Liberals view the Nationals? Are they sort of like the relative that you can't really stand but you have to live with?
It seems an unfair analogy, but I reckon there's something in that. There's been a lot of frustration on both sides during the last two terms of Parliament, especially the last term. Real frustration. There have been moments where the Nationals have been willing to take issues to the brink and really infuriate the Liberals. Even small things. There was a moment when Barnaby Joyce was ruled ineligible from Parliament and Malcolm Turnbull, I think, planned to have, I think, Nigel Scullion as the acting Deputy Prime Minister because Barnaby Joyce was no longer in Parliament as of that moment, had to go to a by-election. Even that issue became a source of tension between the Nationals and Malcolm Turnbull's office in terms of how they resolved that. Obviously, there's been a big debate about the push in Queensland for federal support for a coal-fired power station. The Queensland Nationals really took that to the brink and caused grief for Liberal MPs in Victoria who don't want to go to the election, telling voters that they will put federal support behind a new coal-fired power station. These things are very hard to resolve, source of huge friction, and that's why I think the obvious solution for the longer term is greater differentiation between the parties.
And just on that coal thing, I would say I think that many Liberals were frustrated, with the extreme push on coal-fired power stations and the idea that there would be government support for new ones or to keep old ones open. I think there was a feeling that, you know, Adani's one thing, you know, because that's a local regional thing where you can talk about jobs and prospects for your children, but to actually broaden that out into sort of this huge coal push that some of the LNP seems to have gone on with is frustrating at Liberal HQ, I think.
They have to accept that this is the structure of the Australian Federation in a sense, because the Liberals have to accept that the Queensland Nationals will want to appeal to their home home people. It's perfectly natural. And in a sense, you know, you can tell just how positive the Adani coal mine and a coal-fired power station is in Queensland, in the way in which even Bill Shorten won't diss the idea of that Adani coal mine going ahead. He has to be very careful about what he says when he's in Queensland. So the Queensland Nationals, they're just sticking up for their people, and it's completely logical. But it's been this structural difficulty within the coalition on how they manage those differences.
Well, it does. It becomes a brand thing, doesn't it? Because if you have, a very, very pro-coal sort of lobby up sitting up there in Queensland, who, let's face it, more than flirt with climate denialism, and then that reflects sort of badly on the entire coalition brand, which is what, you know, people in MPs in the urban seats worry about.
Jackie, let's talk about Barnaby Joyce. He's been in the headlines for the past couple of years, and often for all the wrong reasons. Do you see Barnaby as a problem for the Nationals, or is he still an asset? Because love him or hate him, he's real.
He's sort of like, he's sort of like an extremely intangible sort of resource or asset or something. Like, I mean, if you harness him correctly, he can work for the Nats, because there's no denying that he's really good at getting headlines. He's really good at getting press. He's really good at arguing the case for regional Australia in a colourful way that makes people sit up. And I don't think you could say that he's not a really strong advocate for his constituents. But on the other hand, he's not the leader now. He is constantly, you could say he's sort of undermining the leader quite openly, really, and making it very known that he would like the leadership back, and at some point he will go for the leadership back, most probably after the election, when the leadership spills or is thrown open. So he's a little bit of the Tony Abbotts about him, like until the system sort of works him out one way or the other. Like, he gets worked through the system either by popping up back up as leader, or by, I don't know, leaving parliament. He's going to be either an asset or a real liability, because it's just very hard to see how Michael McCormack can get any real space to build his own leadership while Barnaby is still sitting in his party room. And it's probably going to be a much, a reduced party room. The dynamics will be different. And then there's, I suppose, David Littleproud coming up maybe through the middle. But look, he's a wild card and a very untamable sort of force.
Now, you mentioned Michael McCormack, the Nationals leader and deputy prime minister. I think it's fair to say he's not exactly a political powerhouse, but is the criticism of him, even from within his own party, justified, do you think, David?
I think that the logical criticism of him, which is justified, is that he doesn't cut through. The Nationals have been accustomed to a leader in Barnaby Joyce who cuts through, who makes waves with his interventions. That's something that Michael McCormack does not do, does not aspire to do. He's actually a kind of a peacekeeper at the top of the party at the moment because of the differences that they've had over the last couple of years. Now, that's, I think, not great for them in a campaign. They do need a stronger voice, but it's also important, I think, for the coalition as a whole that they've been showing unity, and Michael McCormack has been campaigning alongside Scott Morrison to show that unity of government. Pro-coal messages have been brushed away. Some of the other more belligerent messages have been softened because they've got to appeal to the middle ground during the campaign. I think that's quite logical. There will be a debate after the election about their leadership. I see Barnaby Joyce as an old volcano, full of energy, full of power, completely unpredictable and not always helpful. And so he may, his role after the election is going to be fascinating, but I don't see them turning back to him. I just don't see that. I think his interventions actually do reduce his chances of coming back as leader, despite his obvious desires. And that does mean that they may want to move on with a new generation, and I think that's where David Littleproud does step in as a contender. Has not put his hand up in the past, been very careful not to buy in to those internal rivalries, but that'll change after the election.
I love that description of Barnaby as a volcanic force.
He can smother them all, can't he? It's actually and this is the thing that that both parties and Labor found out in the past. Former leaders, there's just something that happens to people when they have power and then they lose it. It makes them completely unpredictable. Only Julia Gillard has handled it in a way that is predictable and helpful. And I think Barnaby Joyce will stay in Parliament and therefore will be a force to be reckoned with.
There is quite a strong comparison to Abbott there, I think, because they're both really great retail politicians. They've both got a sort of a really good way of communicating and cutting through. They're both great campaigners, and in a way, they've both been, you know, very successful leaders. But they will not go away, and they will not make life easy. They won't retire from politics.
Now, you've both covered quite a few elections. I'm going to put you both on the spot here at this roughly midway point through the campaign and ask for a short and sharp prediction from both of you of the likely outcome on May 18.
Well, I've been saying in conversations with both sides, just in the background chats on the phone, I say, look, 66% chance of a Labor victory, 33% chance of a coalition victory, because you can never be sure until the final 3 weeks. We're currently in a lull in this campaign. We're in a lull where the most interesting announcements are the car park that's going to be next to the train station. You know, it's a local council election at the moment. We haven't seen it really ramp up, and we'll see that in the final 3 weeks. Now, I do think that Labor is in a strong position to get something like 15 more seats. It's a reasonable forecast based on how they've been travelling all the way up to this point. But we're in a dynamic campaign and you can never really be sure. Getting back to the Nats and the Libs in their two key states, New South Wales and Queensland, the coalition primary vote is about 7 points down in Queensland compared to the last election. The coalition primary vote in New South Wales is down about 5 points since the last election. They've got a long way, a lot of ground to make up, but you can never be sure about what might happen in the final 3 weeks.
Yeah, I'm gonna say me too on Dave's sort of 15 seat majority. I would say 15 or 16. I think it's a really for Labor, that is. I think it's a really interesting campaign in a way, because the actual campaign itself is, dare I say it, quite boring. There's a lot of there's this sort of blizzard of numbers being chucked at voters about tax-free thresholds and franking credits, and, you know, money that's going to be put into health and money that's going to be taken out of your pocket, you know, via negative gearing. There's a hell of a lot of sort of economic information that I think is quite dense for voters to absorb via the nightly news or via Facebook or however people usually get their news now. However, I don't think there's a lot of attention being paid to the campaign, and also because we've had, like, you know, holidays and stuff, but there is quite a lot of attention being paid to the result. I think there is a strong mood for change. I think probably a lot of people have already made up their mind. Pre-polling has sort of, I think, already opened or is opening this week, and I think a lot of people will be casting their votes away, and maybe a lot of other people will just be deciding or, you know, thinking about it, pricking up their ears maybe a week before the actual election. I think people are so over politics. They're so over politicians. They don't really want to campaign, but they do want to cast their vote.
Jackie and David, thank you for your time. Good luck with the rest of the campaign. Sleep well, eat well, and we will catch up soon.
Thanks, Bevan.
Thank you.
Do you regret that you didn't ask questions about where the profits would go?
No more than Tony Burke and the Australian Labor Party or the Queensland Labor Party when they didn't. This was their recommendation. So go right ahead. Knock yourself out. Have the inquiry. I can't wait to call.
As far as scandals go, it's not exactly Watergate, but this story does involve water, and it's fast becoming a distraction the government could do without. Water experts and Labor say the coalition paid too high a price for water rights owned by a company linked to the Cayman Islands tax haven. The company was founded by the current Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, and the minister who signed off on the sale was former Deputy PM Barnaby Joyce. Both have strongly denied any wrongdoing. Under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, the Commonwealth buys water from irrigators and other rights holders to inject it back into the struggling river system. In his attempt to downplay the story, Joyce conducted a disastrous interview with ABC's Patricia Cavalis on Monday evening.
Because we followed their precedent, he flees.
So do you think then, given there are so Barnaby Joyce, I'm trying to be patient and try not to have a shouty interview because I just think some key questions have to be answered. Respectful tone. I think it's really important that we don't yell over each other. So the question is, do you support...
But that explanation didn't satisfy Labor, and it's now promising a full judicial inquiry into the transaction should it win the election. To explain what this is all about and where it could go next, Eric Bagshaw joins us from Barnaby Joyce's Northern New South Wales electorate of New England. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bevan.
You've been spending some time over the last couple of days in Tamworth and Tenterville. Eric, tell us how the locals are reacting to this.
It really depends on who you talk to. Now, some are outraged, and the reason for that is because in and around New England, it's in drought. Water is a massive and controversial issue. So the idea that the local member could be involved in some sort of mismanagement of it is obviously causing a lot of upset in the region.
And so then the controversy with what Barnaby's doing and what Barnaby is alleged to have done just continues to taint what we see is a problem with our local member, or what I see is a problem with our local member.
You're a Nationals voter?
I have been, but I'm not going to be. I'm looking towards independent because I do want some people in there keeping them honest and keeping them working. Because when they've got a ginormous majority, all they say is we got the mandate from the people, and then they don't do anything.
But at the same time, the story has basically produced a lot of smoke but no fire at this point. Barnaby Joyce has denied really any allegations of improper action. And a lot of people on the ground are sort of thinking, well, what does it actually involve? And most of them are sort of saying, look, if there's another step to this, if it can actually be demonstrated that Barnaby personally authorised and acted improperly, or indeed if there are wider consequences from this buyback, then that is really when what's going to change their mind. But at this point, people are sort of teetering on the edge, and it's kind of contributing to this idea that there's a general malaise in Canberra, that it's another example of, you know, politician snouts in the trough, but there's no real smoking gun. So we'll have to see, wait for an Auditor General's report under the government or the Commission of Inquiry that Labor has set up. Now, of course, all of this kind of contributes to the wider issue here, which is the election coming up, and Barnaby has actually increased his lead in this electorate in the lead up to this particular polling day. So people are thinking maybe it's another chink. It might hurt him a bit, but it may not be the fatal blow that a lot of the independents are hoping for.
So Barnaby has already had a pretty turbulent year or two in his personal life. He had to stand down as Deputy Prime Minister, and we don't really know how the electorate will respond to all of that. Are you saying it's too early to tell whether this could affect his re-election chances, or do you think, based on your conversations, there'll be no impact at all?
Look, I think it really depends on the strength of the independent candidate running here, and that's a guy by the name of Adam Blakester. He's running a Cathy McGowan-style campaign, a really strong local support group. He's got some momentum, but it's really dyed-in-the-wool Nationals country here. Not just in this electorate in New England, but also Page next door, and for a long time, Cowper. So it takes a lot to shift votes. And I think a sign of just how confident Barnaby is that I was at a candidates forum last night and Barnaby himself didn't show up.
Wow. How did that go down with people who had rocked up to listen?
Not well. It goes to this idea that perhaps he feels like he's got it in the bag. Of course, he picked up a few percentage points in the by-election in the wake of some of that personal fiasco last year and the Section 44 issues. So there's a sense that the incumbent feels like he's basically too good to go. And I think that's being reflected in the frustration that a lot of people are feeling. And at the Candidates Forum, they're interesting places because really you get very politically engaged people. So I'm not sure how reflective they are of the man on the street, but I've had no less than three people tell me, three unrelated people, that they would bet their house that Barnaby would be re-elected in May.
So you have been talking to people outside that candidate forum, people in the streets. How do they feel about the prospect of a shortened Labor government up there in New England?
It's interesting. Because they really acknowledge that it's very unlikely that a Labor candidate will get in New England itself, Yvonne Langberg, while she's a very capable and promising candidate, it's as I said, really it's very strong Nationals country, and they're much more likely to go independent than they are Labor. But they do recognise that there is a nationwide swing on, and to be honest, what they're really worried about is industrial relations. A lot of the businesses in town, the penalty rates issue and the living wage promise that Bill Shorten has made, which is to essentially raise the wages of casual workers, have got a lot of them really concerned because at the moment they're already stretched. The drought has massively stretched their finances. And the idea of being able to keep on another employee or increase their hours is really concerning them. And that's everyone from the local guitar shop owner in Tamworth through to coffee shops to pet stores. It's been a general feeling across the board that while, look, there's likely to be a change in government and perhaps a change in environmental policy, it's the industrial relations stuff that's really hitting home.
Eric, when you're at your desk in Canberra, normally you're our economics correspondent. So putting that particular hat on just for a minute, what sort of impact has the drought and the lack of water had on the economy in regional Australia more broadly?
It's massive. You can't fail to see the impacts of it in every town I've been to. And so it's not just farmers that are struggling. And you've got to remember, farmers might make up about 20% or even less of the population here. But it's the flow-on effect that's really hurting people. And it basically means that when the land dries up, people can't feed their stock and they often struggle to feed themselves.
Tell me about that. What kind of an impact is the drought having in that sense?
Well, people don't have any money to spend.
Which is closed. Ishka across the road is closing. There's talk of lots of other businesses closing.
Tamworth's about to hit level 4 water restrictions. And it's a possibility that if we don't get good rain, Tamworth can run out of water. There's cash flow issues with farmers at the moment. The town is really a large regional service centre, and it's so dependent on farming. And that's going to be the issue moving forward, not just for landowners, but for retailers, for everyone in business.
So the idea that you would go to the shop and buy an extra, an item of clothing that you might have been looking at, or one of the Tamworth... the Tamworth Country Music Store owner, he mentioned to me that people aren't buying any new instruments anymore. They're just bringing them in for repair. And I think that's a really sort of salient point. It's about just sort of keeping up and keeping your head above water when there really isn't any. So it's a real challenge. And I don't think people in the city necessarily understand as much just how bad a drought can get when it's not just about people who are directly working with it. It's the secondhand flow-on effects that are really having a huge effect on the economies here.
Eric, thank you for your time. Travel safely and we'll see you back in Canberra soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our guests this week, Tony Wright, Eric Bagshaw, David Crowe and Jackie Maley. If you're a Please Explain fan, we'd love for you to tell others about the podcast. And if your app allows you to, leave us a rating and a review. It helps new listeners find us. Remember, you can get in touch with the team. Find the Please Explain email address in our show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Get full access to all our election coverage and special events by becoming a subscriber today. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Nicole Purcell and David Escort. Field recording by Debbie Harrington. Technical assistance from David McMillan. Special thanks also to Tom McKendrick, our head of audio. I'm Bevan Shields. Thanks for listening.